Finance Law Introductory Podcast on the Banker-Customer Relationship. The purpose of this podcast is just to introduce you to three specific ideas that we're focusing on in problem-answering terms in the Law of Finance course in 2009-2010. The first thing we're focusing on is the relationship of banker and customer and how we would best think about that. The second thing we're thinking about is the banker's duty of confidentiality. What, for example, if a banker lets out confidential information about someone's financial affairs or accounts to a third party? Will the bank face liability to compensate that customer? And if so, in what circumstances? And then the third thing is what happens when there are forged checks or fraudulent payment instructions? Who bears the liability for loss there? Principally, what we're thinking about is in what circumstances will the bank bear that liability? And in what circumstances will a customer bear that liability? So to begin at the beginning, what's the nature of the relationship between banker and customer? This all begins with Foley and Hill in the House of Lords in 1848, with Lord Cottenham's dicta to the effect that in ordinary circumstances, a bank is not a fiduciary. Okay, so the relationship between banker and customer is ordinarily a purely contractual relationship. Okay? That's very important. So when money's paid into a bank under a mistaken understanding that the bank is entitled to act in a specific manner, that doesn't mean that the bank holds those monies on trust so that, for example, the claimants who claim they're entitled to the monies ultimately can bring a trusts law claim against the bank. Instead, when the bank receives that money, it does so on a purely contractual basis and the contract is with its customer. Okay, so that's one of the ramifications of there not being a fiduciary obligation. Similarly, when a bank provides references as to a customer's credit worth, which fairly often in commercial transactions a bank will be asked to do, and because a bank doesn't act as a fiduciary, the bank doesn't owe fiduciary obligations to its customer in the provision of those references. So any obligations will be governed purely by common law, principally by the tort of negligence or by anything in the party's contract. But it's not a fiduciary law question. So it's none of those utmost good faith type tests. So it's Box and Barclays Bank that tells us about money's not being held on trust for third parties, for example, when it's received by a bank. Turner or the Royal Bank of Scotland in the Court of Appeal governs this idea about giving references and not being a fiduciary then either. So there are lots of cases following Foley and Hill. Hershorn and Evans is another one where Lord Justice MacKinnon takes the idea that when money is transferred to a bank, it's received outright by the bank and not in any sense held on trust. So that's important. Ordinarily, this whole area is taken out of the fiduciary context. If it was a fiduciary relationship, then all kinds of other constructive trusts and other fun things could have applied. Are there any implied terms into this banking contract beyond things that might actually be in the contract itself? Well, N. Joachimson and Swiss Bank Corps from 1921, which is a case that followed on from the 1914-18 war and involved enemy aliens who were always treated differently by English law. Lord Justice Atkin describes the banker-customer relationship in the following way. It's just a contractual relationship. The bank undertakes to receive money and to collect bills for its customers' accounts. But any proceeds that are received are not held on trust for the customer. Instead, the bank takes those proceeds and undertakes to repay them, says Lord Justice Atkin. It includes a promise to repay any part of the amount due against the written order of the customer addressed to the bank at its branch. So the old-fashioned 1924 idea is that you can only bring your claim against your bank at the particular branch where you do your business. It's still a slightly antique idea that the human being is going to be connected to the bank in some way and everyone will know one another, so you've got to go to your branch. Query whether or not that's how modern banking works when it's all done electronically. An important idea from Lord Justice Atkin, the customer on his part undertakes to exercise reasonable care in executing his written orders so as not to mislead the bank or to facilitate forgery. So that apparently is an implied term in an ordinary vanilla banking arrangement. Payments to be made by the bank on behalf of the customer must be done by means of a demand in writing. So a bank isn't required to do anything in relation to its customer until you've made a demand. I would suggest these days, you know, electronic transmissions and internet banking must constitute a demand, but otherwise that's why we fill in all those payment slips and write out checks and all those kind of things, and that's always stood for a demand hitherto. So that's, in brief, the nature of the banking relationship. So we've taken it out of the fiduciary context. We come then, heading 1.3, to the banker's duty of confidentiality. Now, what's important is there is a general duty of confidentiality on bankers in relation to its customers' affairs, and that will be to do with anything directly relating to its bank accounts or anything ancillary to those bank accounts. But Lord Justice Banks, in Turnier and National Provincial and Union Bank of England from 1924, sets out the four exceptions to this duty of confidentiality. So what we're thinking about is, what if, for example, a bank employee lets out information relating to a customer's accounts and financial affairs to third parties? In what circumstances will the bank be breaching its duty of confidentiality and thus owe liability in damages to compensate its customer? In what circumstances can it be excused from that? Well, Lord Justice Banks tells us that there are four heads of qualification. First, where disclosure is made under compulsion by law. Secondly, where there is a duty to the public to disclose the information. Thirdly, where the interests of the bank require disclosure. And fourthly, where the disclosure is made by the express or implied consent of the customer. So we need to think about those. Turner and the Royal Bank of Scotland is a recent case which has applied Turnier, so it's still the law. The duty of confidentiality, according to cases like Importers and Westminster Bank, begins as soon as there's a relationship of banker and customer. And there's certainly a relation of banker and customer, says the Privy Council, Importers and Westminster Bank, where money has been accepted by a bank on the footing that the bank undertakes to honour checks and operate accounts on behalf of the customer. So there's no need for it to be a relationship of long standing. As soon as you enter into a banking relationship, then everyone's on. So how far do these duties extend? Well, from Great Western Railway Company and London and County Banking Company Limited, we're told by Lord Davy that there must be some sort of account, either a deposit or a current account or some similar relation, to make a man a customer of a banker. So something to bring that relationship into being. Woods and Martins Bank, however, has drawn that more broadly and said, in a situation in which a bank was providing written investment advice through one of its agents, even though that person receiving the advice didn't actually have an account with the bank at the time, then if that agent is providing investment advice on behalf of the bank to a person, then that puts the bank and the person receiving the advice into the relationship of banker and customer. So that's an extension of a much older idea in the cases that it's only about when you have a bank account between you. So that's the difference between 1901 and 1959, when Woods and Martins Bank is decided. So let's go through the four very quickly. Where disclosure is required by law, I would suggest money laundering regulation is the key example of this now, when bankers are going to be required to make information available to regulators, for example. There are cases like the Libyan Arab Foreign Bank and Bankers Trust case from 1989, where the banker assumed it was compelled by law to make information available to the Federal Reserve Bank of New York when the Fed asked for that information. And the assumption seems to be taken that when a regulator gives you an instruction, that's a circumstance in which you'll make that information available. Still a very grey area about whether or not that permits a breach of contract. Where money laundering regulation, for example, requires it, though, I think that's going to be good enough. Where a duty is owed to the public, well, cases like Joachimsen, where there's a war on, yeah, the First World War, there are Germans defined by the law at the time as enemy aliens within the jurisdiction. It was held in that circumstance that the duty of confidentiality could be breached because it was a situation in which they constituted, quote, a danger to the state or to the public. That's a quote from Lord Finlay in Wells, Blundell and Stevens. So it's that kind of situation, war, where we've held as a duty to the public. More interesting and difficult questions: what happens if it's not something obvious like a war, but we're just talking about a banking collapse, like the collapse of BCCI? It was held in a case called Farrowen and BCCI in 1998, that once BCCI had collapsed, it was in the broader public interest that access to that bank's accounts, records and so on and so forth were made available to public authorities so that we could deal with that banking collapse. So it's war, but it's also become banking collapse as well. But it does seem to be things at that level. The bank's own interest. Well, in cases like Sutherland and Barclays Bank, there may be circumstances in which the bank purporting to act on its own interest might just simply refuse to honour a customer's cheques. So in that case, we have a wife who is gambling, and the bank realised that all of the cheques that were being written were to facilitate gambling. So in a good old school morality, 1938 this is, Mr Justice Duparc upheld the idea that the bank was not only entitled to refuse to pass on these cheques, but when the wife had gone home and complained to her husband that the bank wasn't clearing the cheques, and got her husband to ring the bank and protest on her behalf, the bank said, well, the reason we're not clearing these cheques and processing these cheques is because they're for gambling debts. Your wife is running up gambling debts. And this seemed to be the first her husband knew about it. She then sued the bank for breaching the duty of confidentiality by telling her husband about all this. Mr Justice Duparc took the view she had impliedly authorised the bank to break down the wall of confidentiality in this circumstance because she'd set her husband on to act on her behalf. But that was taken to fall under the heading by a lot of the literature of the bank protecting its own interest. Similarly, authorised disclosure, I think Sutherland and Barclays Bank also falls under authorised disclosure, where a customer waives her right of confidentiality, for example, in turn on the Royal Bank of Scotland, then you cannot rely on your right of confidentiality against the bank if you've already waived that right to confidentiality. So that gives us an idea of some of the cases that have been so far. There aren't very many, and what you're doing is looking at the facts in front of you and thinking, is this a circumstance where it's appropriate to breach the duty of confidentiality? So, for example, if a bank suspects crime, is that something which should fall under one of the four heads? And what if that suspicion turns out to be an incorrect suspicion? So how far do we go? And that's why it's important it's a contractual relationship, because I would suggest if it was a fiduciary relationship between banker and customer, that would have pitched that obligation much higher, and you'd have a duty of kind of utmost good faith, if you like, if you're acting as a fiduciary in relation to the maintenance of your client's confidence. So there's still some grey area there, not a huge amount of case law on this in the modern age. We might wonder, you know, is the morality still the same? For example, in relation to gambling, I mean, think about how many poker sites there are now on the internet, how many football teams are advertising gambling. You know, casinos now have become lawful under the Gaming Act. You know, is our morality no different? And would some of those cases still be decided the same way? The gambling wife case, for example. Move on to our third heading briefly, bank mandates and payments. What you're really thinking about here is the principle in London Joint Stock Bank and Macmillan, heading 2.2. If the customer draws the cheque in a manner which facilitates fraud, he is guilty of a breach of duty as between himself and the banker, and he will be responsible to the banker for any loss sustained by the banker as a natural and direct consequence of this breach of duty. So we have to ask the question, when can the bank be liable and when will the customer be liable for any loss that's caused by a forged cheque, for example? You know, who bears that liability? So London Intercontinental Trust and Barclays Bank from 1980 took the view that while the bank was acting in accordance with its instructions from its customer and processing cheques with the genuine signatory's name on there, then the bank bore no liability. Whereas if, for example, the customer knew that the signatory was involved in some kind of fraudulent scheme, then the bank is not liable, but rather the customer should have taken some action to prevent that fraud from persisting, and maybe the obligation is borne by the customer in that circumstance. And that same principle is approved in Simmons and Barclays Bank in 2003. There's always an interesting question that comes up: what happens when your payment is discharging another person's debts? In Grosvenor casinos, the problem here was that the casino was complaining that someone who had come into gamble in its casino carrying bearer checks for a huge amount of money. The problem here was that the bank refused to honour those checks. The person gambled with an amount of about 99 million, I can't remember if it's pounds or if it's dollars now, and had losses of about 18 million. And the two, the two bearer checks in question amounted to 6 million pounds, and the bank said, we're not going to process these. The duties are owed only to the customer. So the casino had no right against the bank when it tried to get payment under these checks. The bank didn't owe a duty to the casino that it would obey the instructions in relation to these bearer checks, because the bearer checks have been issued to the customer, and the contractual relationship is only between bank and customer. It's not a promise to third parties that the bank will make those payments to the third party. There will be situations, Wilson and United Counties Bank, between banker and customer, where the bank will bear liability for a wrongful repudiation of a cheque. So if a bank says, we're not going to honour this cheque, and that causes loss to the customer, when it was a wrongful repudiation of the cheque, so there's no contractual right to repudiate it, for example, then that customer will be able to recover compensation for any loss that it suffers as a result of the bank refusing to pay out on that cheque. London Joint Stock Bank and Macmillan, Lord Finlay, sets out at some length the situation in which there are fraudulent payment instructions or forged cheques. In that case, we have a busy partner who is approached by one of his employees, knowing the partner's in a hurry and about to leave the office, and the employee says, can you just sign these cheques? And in fact, this is a fraudulent scheme. The cheques are going to be taken by that employee himself to divert money away from the partnership, knowing that the partner wouldn't really look at the cheques and would just sign them and then rush off. The relation between banker and customer, which says Lord Finlay, is that of debtor and creditor, with a superadded obligation on the part of the banker to honour the customer's cheques. So the banker is supposed to honour the customer's cheques if the account is in credit. Okay? A cheque drawn by a customer is in point of law a mandate to the banker to pay the amount out. It's beyond dispute that the customer is bound to exercise reasonable care, however, in drawing the cheque, to prevent the banker being misled. If he draws the cheque in a manner which facilitates fraud, he's guilty of a breach of duty as between himself and the banker, and he will be responsible to the banker for any loss sustained by the banker as a natural and direct consequence of this breach of duty. And so the question on the facts of at the London Joint Stock Bank case was whether or not the client partnership there should have taken greater care in the way in which it was going to sign off on its cheques. It's often been said that no one is bound to anticipate the commission of a crime, so you're not required to go around assuming everyone you're dealing with is a criminal, and that to take advantage of blank spaces left in a cheque for the purpose of increasing the amount is forgery, which the customer is not bound to guard against. However, says Lord Finlay, I am unable to accept any such proposition without very great qualification. Everyday experience shows that advantage is taken of negligence for the purpose of perpetrating frauds, and as the customer and banker are under a contractual relationship, it appears obvious that in drawing a cheque, the customer is bound to take usual and reasonable precautions to prevent forgery. So you've got to look at the facts and just think, have you taken usual and reasonable precautions? So in a situation, for example, where you're an artist or you're an actor and you have an agent that acts on your behalf, the way in which you deal with that person, if you let them use your checkbook, have you taken the usual and reasonable precautions? That might make a difference if you've known that person for a long time, if you've worked together for ages and you have a reason to trust them, you know, it might be different in other situations. If it's a commercial organisation, a large company, for example, do you have systems in place, for example, having two signatories to make sure that things aren't going to be stolen from you by means of cheques being forged? So that's the kind of factual scenario that we're thinking about here. The House of Lords found for the bank in London Joint Stock Bank and Macmillan, the partnership case, because it was thought the partnership simply hadn't taken enough care. There are cases like Société Générale and Metropolitan Bank, where there was a cheque prepared properly, made out to £8, and then somebody added a Y to 8 to make it 80, and therefore managed to get £72 fraudulently as a result. It was held in this situation that we wouldn't ordinarily expect a bank to spot this, because during the clearing system, the question that might be raised by the customer is, well, why didn't you spot that, the bank? Why didn't you spot there was an extra letter? And it was held in this particular case, it's unreasonable to expect the bank is going to spot that. If it's one letter added, you know, and the same kind of ink and everything else on the cheque, how would that stand out? So the question to ask there on the fact is it a sufficiently significant change that you think the bank ought to have spotted it, so the bank should be liable? Or is it such a trifling thing that we don't think it's reasonable that a bank should have spotted it? Okay. And so on and so forth with various cases in the same sort of fashion. Greenwood and Martin's Bank puts an onus on the customer to inform the bank if it knows there are fraudulently drawn cheques. For example, in that case, a husband failed to inform the bank that his wife had been fraudulently cashing cheques out of his account. And therefore the bank won't bear liability there because the husband hadn't discharged his liability. In Tai Hing Cotton Mill, we're told the customer didn't owe duties to take reasonable precautions in the management of his business to prevent fraudulent cheques being presented against its accounts. There, an accounts clerk had forged the managing director's signature on cheques for a total amount of 5.5 million Hong Kong dollars, and the bank paid out under the cheques. Obviously, the company came to try and recover the money from the bank. The bank's argument was that the company's internal control systems just weren't good enough to stop one clerk being able to forge this particular signature. It was held on the fact, however, that the only duty the customer bore was to exercise due care when drawing cheques, not to permit fraud, and if it finds fraud, to notify the bank. And that doesn't impose more extensive duties of maintaining internal control systems. Now, I would suggest, however, that in a world where we have FSA regulation, if you're an FSA-regulated institution, the SISC rulebook, S-Y-S-C, requires that all regulated institutions put appropriate systems and controls in place. And we might ask now, in that context, does that impose a new obligation on a bank? You know, should a bank be more careful? Should a bank actually have those kind of systems in place now? Is it a different world? Discuss. So you see, in this area, you know, the factual scenarios are quite simple. The cases give you some nice facts to play with. You just look up at whether the facts in front of you do or don't comply with that kind of factual matrix, and argue your way to your conclusion. And there's often a lot you can say about whether or not old-fashioned banking practice is still the kind of banking practice we have today. Just quickly about the corporate liability of banks, LSU and dollar land holdings we've discussed in relation to knowing receipts. Selangor United Rubber Estates and Craddock No. 3, back from 1968, suggests that we can attribute knowledge from bank officers to the bank in ordinary circumstances, where the bank's knowledge would ordinarily have put it on inquiries to the presence of fraud. In Carrick Rubber and Burden in 1972, the manager of a bank was induced to pay out on a cheque, which was actually being presented to the bank as part of a fraudulent scheme. It was held that the banker bore a contractual duty, so under the contract between banker and customer, of care and skill, and the level of care and skill was the level of care and skill required of a reasonable banker. Because there was a large amount of money being moved in Carrack, it was held that the bank would be liable under its contractual duty of care to the customer, not any of the fiduciary duties that we've talked about recently in the course, knowing receipt to some assistance and those kind of things. Kind of in the background of all of this, though, in Gray and Johnston, is the idea from Lord Cairns in 1868 that we can't set this test too high, however, or that will interfere with ordinary banking business. If we're going to attribute knowledge too much, if we're going to require too much of bankers, we're going to stop ordinary banking business being done efficiently. Now, the obvious question for you to deal with there is, well, that was a decision in 1868 when everything was being done with, you know, old-fashioned ink pens dipped into ink wells and all those kind of Scrooge's office things from A Christmas Carol, whereas in an age of computers, you know, can we expect better from our banks? The more modern cases, however, Selangor and Karaka 1968-1972, there goes my text, sorry. The more modern cases, Barclays Bank and Quincare from 1992 and Lipkin, Gorman and Carpnell in the Court of Appeal from 1992, suggest that bankers are entitled to assume honesty. They're entitled to assume you're dealing with honest people. The question for Lord Justice Parker in Lipkin, Gorman and Carpnell is whether or not a reasonable and honest banker would have known of the relevant facts. This again seems to be different from money laundering regulation and the kind of standards that modern financial regulation is applying. So it's interesting, 1868 Lord Cairns wants to set the test quite low. Selangor and Carrack set it actually quite high. You know, if bank officers know about things, we'll attribute that knowledge to the bank. In line pretty much with the old kind of Baden categories. But the more modern cases are suggesting that we can assume honesty. I know it's borrowing again from fiduciary law, but that's in line with Macmillan and Bishopsgate, where Mr. Justice Millett is saying, account officers are not detectives, you're entitled to assume you're dealing with honest men. So again, in the 21st century now, we might ask, hang on, hasn't financial regulation, particularly money laundering regulation, changed that culture so bankers are supposed to spot things? But is it just they're supposed to spot suspicious transactions that look like money laundering, drug dealing and those kind of things, something out of the ordinary? And is that the same as saying that we're imposing duties on them to spot fraud in more general circumstances, you know? Or is money laundering regulation just directed at organised crime, you know? So, difficult to know quite where we should draw the line these days. So that's what I really wanted to draw your attention to in this podcast here. The banker's duty to honour the liability and dishonouring of cheques on page 103 under heading 4. Just from a Farnian Midland Bank, Lord Justice Diplock tells us what the court must do is to look at all the circumstances at the time of the acts complained of and ask itself, were those circumstances such as would cause a reasonable banker possessed of such information about his customer as a reasonable banker would possess to suspect that his customer was not the true owner of the cheque. And that seems to me to be a useful principle over the top. You know, look at the circumstances. In an age of mass banking, where we all have bank accounts and it's all done electronically, the question just has to be asked, what should we require of bankers? Yeah? Should we require them to reach a high standard and spot these things? Or do we say there's simply too much business and it's done electronically, how could the banker know their customers in this kind of way? Or do we say, well, they are making billions in profit, so surely they can afford to put systems in place where they do check out these things. And of course they do now have software programs to spot these kind of things going on electronically. So have the banks almost through their own competence created a liability for themselves, a rod for their own back, where they are accepting that they will look for odd patterns? You know, if someone is suddenly making a payment in the USA when they've lived all their life in rural Lincolnshire and made all their payments in a very small locale, you know, should the bank spot there's something out of the ordinary there, and should they therefore bear a liability if they allow a payment to go through when it seems to be completely out of the ordinary? It's a real problem, of course, if you then go on holiday to America, your credit card gets stopped. Okay, we'll leave that there, but we can see where the lines are. We can see there are lots of facts on the cases, lots of things to play with. Very good. Sorry this has banged on so long. It was meant to be a summary, but there we go. You might find it more useful than listening to all the lectures again.